from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, first big city, I guess, to not have a daily newspaper pretty soon. Pretty darn sudden. This just in. Nothing's just in. The New York-based outfit, known jocularly as Advance Publications, I think is probably more appropriate name for them. Maybe Retreat Publications might be more appropriate, has announced they're adopting a plan, a model that they developed in a college town in Michigan, because New Orleans is so much like a college town in Michigan, really indistinguishable. Publishing a newspaper, a print newspaper, only three times a week, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. And this town has been, I think it's safe to say, kind of a blaze, unlike Los Angeles, which shrugs in kind of bored disdain as the dog trainer there continues on its inexorable mission to be indistinguishable from my weekly reader in both size and depth. This town is a blaze because this is the newspaper that was in the water. I mean, the folks from the newspaper were in the water with these people during the, not the hurricane, the federal flood. If you're in any doubt about that still, just as of Friday, The Big Uneasy, the film that tells the story of the 2005 flood, went on Netflix for the first time. I don't know if that was because it was the start of hurricane season or just fiscal year kind of stuff. But anyway, there it is for you. Nonetheless, this was the newspaper that was whose folks were in the water. And they made the mistake of putting the paper out online during the time when the printing plant was flooded, which I guess gave the folks in New York an idea. Hey! So they decided they're going to direct everyone here now to, if you want news 7 days a week, why don't you go to the world's ugliest, worst designed website? Because that's what we've got. And you get the newspaper 3 days a week, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. So folks here, as I say, are kind of enraged. A lot of tumult. There's going to be a rally tomorrow about it. A rally for your newspaper. Imagine. That's what I'm saying. It's not like a college town in Michigan. And my favorite this week was a couple people came up and said, you know, my dog is trained to get a treat every morning when he retrieves the Times-Picayune. What am I going to say to him on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday? Go fetch something else? Go fetch the mail. And of course, you know, nothing happens on Sunday. Nothing that would need to be reported on Monday, like the Super Bowl game, which is going to be here next February. Well, folks, why don't you wait until Wednesday to find out what happened at the Super Bowl? That's the plan. Now, my plan is a little bit different. Of course, everybody's trying to come up with ideas for what to do to deal with this situation. And Advance Publications owns some popular, very... Oh, by the way, the Times-Picayune still makes a profit. The newspaper makes a profit. The newspaper has the most readership per population of any daily newspaper in the 50 largest American cities. And 36% of the people in New Orleans do not have internet. So it's a really good place to try this plan. It's very much like a college town in Michigan. My idea is, okay, the folks at Advance Publications may not like the Times-Picayune very much anymore, or New Orleans, but they do like their glossy magazines, which are, strangely enough, at least partially, available online. So why don't we all just take their advice, go read as much of their glossy magazines as available for free online, and not pay any money for the print editions anymore. Seems fair, doesn't it? Hello, welcome to the show.
Whoa, ooh, ooh. So, need some newspaper at my feet. We go need someone to tell them to. We don't have to be eye to eye,
nor face to face.
I'm not asking for miracles,
nor savings grace.
And I don't need another heart
to heaven hold.
All I want is a friend that I can talk to.
So
from the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, where it's hurricane season, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, it's exciting. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the Le Show program. And news of the godly, first of all, since it is the weekend, the Italian Bishops' Conference has issued guidelines on child protection that inform its bishops they are not obliged to report illicit facts of child abuse to the police. So they're off the hook. The new guidelines were released after the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith advised every bishop conference to create a document covering child protection if they did not already have one. One of the conferences that was lacking such documentation was the Italian Bishops Conference, which works under Pope Benedict, under the jurisdiction, I believe they mean, here in the Belfast Telegraph account of the story. In the new 5-page document, which advised Italian bishops on how to deal with pedophilia, they failed to focus on one of the most important and obvious means of combating the crime, informing police authorities. Instead, the document read, under Italian law, the bishop, given that he holds no public office, nor is he a public servant, is not obliged to report illicit facts of the type covered by this document to the relevant state judicial authorities. Unquote. So they've learned their lesson. The prayer group met regularly at St. Anthony of Padua, a Roman Catholic church in Camden, New Jersey, where behind the modest brick facade, impassioned, spontaneous, full-throated confessions were shared. These meetings took place in the early 1980s, reports the New York Times, during a boom in charismatic Christianity that encouraged the dozens of participants to feel the Holy Spirit and unburden themselves of guilt for their sins. Into this mix of faith and support of fellow believers walked Pedro Hernandez, who told the prayer group he had strangled a boy and left the body in a dumpster, according to his sister and a leader of the group who said he was present at the time. Rivera, the leader of the group, Thomas Rivera, said to the New York Times last week, it was not his place to call the police after that confession because, quote, he did not confess to me one-on-one, he confessed to the group. Unquote. So he's learned his lesson. But it's not just the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Don't be mistaken. Don't be misled. Martin Weiss is the Hollywood talent manager whose company represented child actors that had landed roles in such series as iCarly and Good Luck Charlie, shows that rhymed. What else do you want? As well as on network shows and movies. This week in Van Nuys, he pleaded no contest during a pretrial hearing to two charges of oral copulation with a child under the age of 14. He was sentenced to a year in jail and 5 years probation. Sentence was suspended for time served. He's registering as a sex offender and must enter a treatment program, and he's not permitted to be in the presence of anyone under 18 without another adult present, like maybe, priest. He was arrested last November after the victim and former client, that's convenient, told police in an affidavit he was sexually assaulted by Weiss 30 to 40 times over a three-year period when the boy was 11 or 12 years old. Weiss dissolved his company soon after. 30 or 40 times. But he was getting good parts. Well, they both were. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's news of the godly and the non-godly. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a week in which the importance of renaming stuff is brought further to the fore, or further to the fur. The FDA decided this week that they were not going to allow the renaming of high fructose corn syrup, which has received so much attention in recent years from nutrition-oriented writers, journalists and others, polemicists, for its alleged role in everything from contributing to heart disease to the obesity epidemic. And the manufacturers of high fructose corn syrup decided that what they really needed to deal with the situation was to stop putting it in all the processed food. No! Change the name to corn sugar. Corn sugar. The FDA said, no, you can't. Sugar is a crystalline substance. This is not a crystalline substance. That was the basis for the decision. Now, I have a suggestion as to what name does not require a crystalline substance, the implication of a crystalline substance, that they could change high fructose corn syrup to. How about yellow slime? On a similar matter, hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, the gas drilling technique that involves fracturing of rock formations to get at the natural gas trapped within, has been linked to environmental problems such as groundwater pollution, toxic air emissions, and earthquakes. It's been linked to earthquakes in both this country and England, as you know, if you've been listening to this broadcast. It is also spurring a golden age of natural gas that's reducing the price of gas, and environmentalists worry that'll reduce demand for renewable energy. According to a recent study from LSU, Louisiana State, right up the road, part of the problem might be the word fracking itself. What the frack? The study links phrasing to public opinion. In a survey of 700... I'm so glad LSU is doing this work. It's important work. In a survey of 731 randomly selected Louisiana residents, researchers found people were less likely to support hydraulic fracturing when they heard it called fracking. In other words, the study suggests gas companies would benefit from using other words. Public aversion to the term likely results from the harsh consonants and perhaps the obvious similarity with certain other four-letter word. LSU's Michael Klimek says in a press release. This research shows that the unpleasant sound of the word is at least partially responsible for residents thinking fracking is unsafe and it should not be pursued by the state of Louisiana. If businesses and legislators use another word or description, constituents may be more willing to support hydraulic fracturing. Of course, since it's impossible to assess whether fracking is safe based on its name, it's irrelevant from an environmental or public health perspective. The LSU study is about marketing, focusing on how to make fracking sound safe. An executive told Marketplace, you've heard of that program, maybe, this week, the problem with fracking is that it's honest. The root of it is fracture, and that's just not a very positive thing, says David Plasek. Wow, we got Klimek and Plasek. Of Lexicon Branding, whether there's a fracture in a political party or you fracture your arm, it's just nothing but negative connotations. He also points out that frack is similar to frack, F-R-A-K, a made-up curse word from Battlestar Galactica. Well, that'll do it. The Battlestar Galactica curse. Among the respondents who heard the word fracking, 35% called the process somewhat safe or very safe. 39% said Louisiana should encourage it. When the word wasn't used, those numbers grew to 43 and 52% respectively. Instead of fracking, they heard a way to extract natural gas that involves using a high-pressure injection of water, sand, and chemicals to remove natural gas from rocks deep in the Earth's surface. I'd suggest yellow slime for that, too. I suggest yellow slime when you want to rename anything. But that's just me. And now, hello, I'm me with News of the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addy?
Yes, sir.
You have a good trip?
Mm-hmm. Flew coach.
Of course you did. You're an atom. Mountains of rubble stand in the way of decommissioning the number 4 reactor at the Fuke nuclear plant, part of an unprecedented challenge facing Japan for decommissioning 4 crippled reactors. The number 4 reactor building was open to a handful of media organizations this week for the first time. A reporter from the Tokyo Shimbun described the scene on the fourth floor as looking like that of a battlefield after being bombed. The wall facing the sea had been blown off in a hydrogen explosion.
Yeah, that's nothing.
March of last year. Pipes were severely bent. The reporter said steel frames were twisted and rusted. It was hard for me to believe such a thick wall was blown off over a wide area. The minister in charge of handling the nuclear disaster was also inspecting the number 4 building. What's most under threat in that building is the spent fuel pool, which holds 1,500 fuel assemblies, the equivalent of those in 3 reactors. Many point out the risks of the collapse of the pool if another earthquake strikes the plant. TEPCO released a report stating the structure had an outward bulge of 3 centimeters in a portion of the west wall due to the hydrogen explosion, but did not pose a threat to its structural integrity. The government accepts TEPCO's assurance of the safety of the building. Even if an earthquake representing upper 6 on the Japanese scale of 7 hits, the number 4 building will be able to withstand the impact, the minister said. The wall buckling out is situated away from the pool. But the government has ordered TEPCO to double-check the safety of the building. Of course, the government now owns TEPCO. This makes you feel safe, doesn't it? TEPCO did reinforce the structure of the pool by adding steel support and concrete beneath the pool last July. They also said it would take 2 or 3 weeks for spent fuel rods to start being exposed in the event of the pool's cooling system being knocked out by, like, a quake. This all sounds so good. They envisioned covering the number 4 building with a canopy by next summer to reduce the possibility of the release of radioactive materials into the atmosphere. Next summer. So hold off on all quakes, will you please? Anybody planning to hold a quake? The TEPCO is preparing for decontamination work at number 1, 2, 3 reactor buildings to pave the way for workers to begin retrieving the melted fuel rods. A crane and other equipment needed to move the fuel rods will be installed in next autumn. But there are many uncertainties that could easily derail TEPCO's timetable. Clearing the structure could take more time than expected because concrete blocks and pieces of steel frame are scattered all around in and out of the number 4 reactor pool. They also need to secure a facility to store the fuel rods from the pool, as a common nearby pool has space for only 465 fuel rods. So anybody who wants to store some spent fuel rods, let TEPCO know, will you? Would you please? The reactors will be cooled with emergency cooling pumps even if the existing cooling systems are knocked out, says TEPCO. Of course, they said that the last time.
Stop with the cynicism.
All right. Health authorities in Zurich recently destroyed 10 tons of Ukrainian mushrooms after determining the wild fungi contained unacceptable levels of radiation. They're sounding the alarm because the mushrooms from Ukraine contain too much cesium-137. Ukraine had cleared the mushrooms for export. The laboratory had been on its toes because of the Fuch deal. It ran dozens of tests on various foods from Japan, came up with no radiation-contaminated items. Chemist Rolf Etter was all the more surprised, therefore, to find radiation in food from Ukraine by pure chance. In 2014 tests conducted on frozen wild Ukrainian mushrooms, tolerance levels of cesium-137, radioactive, were well over the acceptable mark. They'd all been imported by the same company. The results mean that 25 years after Chernobyl, dangerous levels of radioactivity are still making their way into the food system. Stuff sticks around.
We're persistent, us Adams.
You are. PG&E and Southern California Edison, operators of two nuclear power reactors, the only two in California, haven't done a comprehensive risk assessment of their plant's vulnerabilities to earthquakes for nearly two decades, according to a Government Accountability Office report. It looked at actually more than 100 operating reactors in the U.S., found that the two companies have never done an assessment using the most up-to-date technology to determine what might happen in case of a tsunami or hurricane. Hurricane? In California? The GAO said PG&E, operator of Diablo Canyon, hasn't updated its seismic risk analysis since 1988. The office found that PG&E has never comprehensively assessed the plant for its vulnerabilities to flooding, like the kind in Japan. Similarly, Southern California Edison, operator of San Onofre near San Diego, hasn't done a comprehensive seismic analysis since 1995. It also hasn't performed a comprehensive flood risk assessment. The GAO criticized the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for not requiring more stringent risk assessments for nuclear plants, especially after Fuch. So we're learning our lessons. We're sapiens. We're the homo that is sapiens.
Don't put your species down.
Okay. The U.S. Energy Department must justify the $750 million it collects annually from the atomic power industry for waste disposal, given that it no longer plans to develop a nuclear waste depository at Yucca Mountain. A three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals said the department's 2010 fee determination was legally defective. It has 6 months to evaluate whether collection of the fee will provide too much or too little revenue to offset costs of the nuclear waste disposal program, which, of course, is not disposing of any nuclear waste. $30 billion has been collected from nuclear power utilities and their consumers for a permanent nuclear waste storage facility. None has been built, but boy, that must be piling up the interest. Interest on $30 billion? That could pay off something in the meantime. In an unusually stark warning, Japan's prime minister, he was prime minister during last year's Fuch crisis, told a parliamentary inquiry this week that the country should discard nuclear power as too dangerous, saying the Fuch accident had pushed Japan to the brink of, quote, national collapse. Ouch. Ouch, I would say. National collapse, ladies and gentlemen. Don't know about that. Don't know whether we like that. The name of the former prime minister, Naoto Kan. He's not a Kondo kind of guy.
No, he didn't.
He warned that politically powerful nuclear industry was trying to push Japan back towards nuclear power despite showing no remorse for the accident. The inquiry, 6 months so far, was started by lawmakers who felt an earlier internal investigation by the government had papered over problems. Kan used the appearance to criticize the relatively pro-nuclear stance of the current prime minister, Noda, who replaced him. Noda has called for restarting Japan's undamaged plants, which have been idled since the thing. He says that's needed to avoid economically crippling power shortages, but that's met resistance from many Japanese voters. Kan, the former prime minister, said Japan's plant safety was inadequate because energy policy had been hijacked by the nuclear village, a term for the power companies and pro-nuclear regulators and researchers that work closely together to promote the industry. He said the only way to break their grip was to form a new regulatory agency staffed with true outsiders like American and European experts. Gorbachev said in his memoirs that Chernobyl exposed the sickness of the Soviet system, Kan said. The Fuk accident did the same for Japan.
He's just bitter.
A potentially faulty sensor at San Onofre near San Diego could have shut down emergency power generators during an earthquake, and it might have happened any time since 1981. Plant operators reported last week to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, according to the Orange County Register. The sensor, with an S, meant to shut down backup nuclear generators if it detects excessive vibration, instead could have been triggered by an earthquake. Beginning shutdown of the generators if loss of normal power began at the same time as a quake. The potential problem was listed as an unanalyzed condition in a report to the NRC because investigation was complete. An NRC spokesman said regulators so far cannot evaluate how serious a safety issue the sensor represented. It has been deactivated while the plant's operators continue their analysis. Loss of the backup generator would not have led immediately to total loss of power. They would have had battery power for 4 hours. Why, that's long enough to listen to some internet radio. And the governor of Fukushima, which is a prefecture or state, has criticized the way the central government went about issuing evacuation instructions for residents at that parliamentary hearing. About the central government's evacuation instructions to residents near Fuk No. 1, Yuhei Sato said, "We had no prior notice, no grounds for the instructions were presented, and the instructions were announced one after another. It was totally beyond us." He said the central government's declaration of a nuclear emergency was problematic, saying in drills the central government was expected to declare an emergency within 30 minutes after receiving a report on the emergency from the power plant. But in this accident, the declaration was announced 2.5 hours. After receiving the report from TEPCO, it was another hour later when the notice arrived at the state government. He did apologize for the state government having overlooked the arrival of data from the System for Prediction of Environmental Emergency Dose Information, SPEEDI, sent by the central government. "We carelessly failed to notice. I apologize for having caused anxiety among residents." The state government's initial response, he said, had shortcomings of its own. There were organizational problems, he said. Sounds like somewhere familiar, after something familiar.
See? It's all over. It's not just us.
It's not just you. Addie, the Atom. News of the Atom, our friend. Clean, safe, cheap, too safe to be clean, to be cheap, to be fee, fee, to be metered. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. A top official from Ukraine, there's that name again, National Olympic Committee, has resigned over allegations he offered to sell thousands of dollars worth of tickets for the London Games on the black market. The committee said in a statement this week that Volodymyr Gerashchenko, the general secretary and second highest ranking official on the Olympic Committee, has stepped down after an emergency meeting. BBC had reported that he had offered to sell up 100 tickets to the Games to a reporter posing as a buyer. That's not right. He's been at his post since 1997. And bars at the official games venues will charge about $7.40 for a small serving of London 2012 red wine at the Olympics. For visitors with an appetite for a traditional British fare, a portion of cod and chips will set them back $12.50. The London 2012 organizers published sample menus this week, claimed the prices were more than comparable to catering costs at other sporting events. Twitter users described the announcement as a shocker. The chief executive of London 2012 said organizers had gone to great lengths to find high-quality, tasty food that celebrates the best of Britain. Uh-oh. A 330-milliliter bottle of Heineken Lager at the Games will cost $6.50, making the equivalent price of a pint $11, more than double the national average price of a pint in the UK. Spectators will pay $3.20 for a toasted tea cake. Won't you? $3.50 for a 500-milliliter bottle of Coca-Cola, if Michael Bloomberg allows it. And $3 for a cup of tea. A family of four should be able to buy food and drinks at the Olympics for under $61.50, according to London 2012. Spectators will be allowed to take their own food to the games, but must carry it in soft bags, not cool boxes. Visitors will be banned from bringing their own alcohol to the venues. You must have official Olympic alcohol. And the RMT union raised the prospect of another strike of transport workers during the game. Staff operating London's network of bicycles for hire are demanding $1,500 bonuses for working during the Olympics. Transport ministers and the mayor of London have urged London residents to bicycle to work during the games because of the overcrowding on the underground commuter trains and the streets. The Olympics. It's a movement. And it can't move.
Got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a room. I said, I've got a room with a view. No, I got a house full of troubles, and I still got this room with a view. That's the best part. Got no pictures on my wall, just a ceiling above my head. Ain't got no carpet on my floor, no pillow. I got a room with a view. Yeah. I've got a house full of trouble and a room with a view of a blue. I said they're closing in on me. Yes, they are. These old walls, you know they're closing in on me. Ain't got no food in my icebox. Says I ain't got no cable. I ain't got nothing on TV. The ceiling is getting low. It's about to touch the floor. There's the blues keep on knocking, knocking at my door. I've got a room with a view. I've got a house full of trouble and a room with a view.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week the New York Times revealed that it's a slow news period. I know, there's massacre in Syria and all sorts of other stuff going on in the world, but that was their explanation for why the ratings for the cable news channels are down. Not because they've bored us silly with, you know, political arguments for a year and a half, but anyway, it is, all right, it's a slow news week, so we're going to open up the phone lines, take advantage of it, and see who's out there on the phone lines here today. So, line A, why not? Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Shearer. I'm Doug Schlegel.
Hi.
I'm a property developer, an owner, and pretty well known in the area up here in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Poughkeepsie.
First-time caller and long-time property developer.
Excellent, Doug. Thank you for calling. And what can I do for you?
I just I've noticed that there's been a wave this week of attention devoted to a particular personality, so-called, and I wanted to alert you and your listeners to some information that I've had funneled to me by various people.
Okay. Doug, before we get into it, the personality you're talking about, it's not Kim Kardashian, is it?
No, sir. A little bit more of moment or import, you might say, supposedly.
Yeah.
If this person actually was who he purported to be, it's Donald Trump.
Donald Trump?
Yes, sir.
Well, he purports to be, of course, a billionaire. There's been some comment about how much his net worth really amounts to.
Mr. Shearer, that's what the media would like you to be questioning.
Oh.
But I'm, as I say, let me just put it this way,
okay.
Sir.
All right.
You see this figure on your television screen.
Yes, sir.
That is identified as Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen any identifying, verifying, certified identification material of any kind that would attest to the existence of Donald Trump? I'm betting the answer is no.
No, I guess I guess you win your bet.
All right, sir. I'm not a betting man.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've been doing work on this for a number of years, ever since this alleged person came into public view. Mainly, I first became aware of him when there was notice that he was teaching courses at the Learning Annex.
I remember that,
And it just struck me, what billionaire teaches courses at the Learning Annex? And then I started doing some digging. And yes, you're correct. There are people who like to question his net worth, but you have to go to ground zero, if I may.
Oh, okay.
And there is no evidence, from what I've heard, and I've heard this from a great number of people who say, go try to find evidence that this person exists, that there is such a person as Donald Trump.
Wow.
And it's a dry hole. You should pardon the expression.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's just, there's no there. This is a figment, a concoction, a confection, some kind of figure that has been whipped up for public display or public anger or public whatever. But go if you do what I did and tried to find actual physical evidence that he exists, you won't find it.
Wow. Now, so you're saying that there's no such person as Donald Trump?
Yes, sir.
That there's no proof that he exists?
That's exactly what I'm saying, sir.
Now, are you pardon me for putting it this way, are you a lone wolf?
Yeah.
Are you part of an organization? Is there a group?
There is a very steadily expanding group of us who are doing this research and are exchanging information with each other about the shocking truth about this so-called Donald Trump figure, whoever he may be, whoever whatever that may be. Is it a hologram? Is it a... I don't know, but yes, we have been kind of vilified in the areas where we operate, and here in Poughkeepsie, where I've had some public appearances and so forth. I've been called in the local paper a Trumper, and that's fine with me, if that's what I have to put up with to get the word out.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
You say you're a property developer in the Poughkeepsie area.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a matter of, and pardon me for putting it this way, but professional jealousy? I mean, he's obviously well known as the gold standard among New York property developers, partly because he puts gold on every property he develops.
No, sir. Let me just say this. If you come to Poughkeepsie and you see the word Schlegel, say it, and you'll be pointed to the Schlegel Plaza, which is the five-star hotel in this area.
I didn't know.
You'll be pointed to the across the river, somewhat down the river in Monmouth, New Jersey, the Schlegel Casino, which is, I think, everybody recognizes now the most distinctive, most successful non-Native American casino in the Northeast.
Wow.
You know, Schlegel casinos have this strange property, Mr. Shearer.
Uh-huh.
Unlike the Trump casinos, we don't go bankrupt with gambling. You ask yourself, how does a person who actually exists go belly up more than once owning a gambling casino?
No,
that can't be real. There's something going on there. There's I don't want to use the word fraud, but there's something really bizarre going on there.
Yeah.
And it can't be that there's an individual. And again, you cannot find documentation.
No,
I've had a $10,000 standing reward for anybody who can produce documentation that proves that there is such a person as Donald Trump.
Wow.
Nobody has come forward.
Hmm.
Now, you know, times are hard.
Yes.
Anybody, even Doug Schlegel could use $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's has presented it. So you can draw your own conclusions.
Doug, it's compelling and interesting.
Thank you.
It has resonance to what other kinds of folks are saying more and more these days.
Yes.
And I just have to ask you, is there a danger that by talking this way publicly, you're sounding, and I'm going to quote Wolf Blitzer on this, that you're sounding a little ridiculous?
Mr. Shearer, you're sounding ridiculous to say that.
Well, you're sounding absurd to say that.
Well, I think you're sounding absurd. This is it's documented that there's no documentation. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's ridiculous about that. If Donald Trump exists, it would be very, very easy for him to get, you know, he gets on television all the time.
Yes, he does.
This so-called personality, it would be very, very easy for him to just say, look, here it is. Here's proof that I exist.
Mm-hmm.
Documentary proof, not that I'm showing up in this ridiculous outfit that any actor could put on and do this voice.
Yeah.
Here's me. Here's proof that there's me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen at the beginning of his
apprentice.
So-called television show. It doesn't happen when he goes on the news.
Yeah.
Why not? You have to ask yourself that.
I think what I have to do, Doug, is move along. Thank you, Doug Schlegel, for participating in this little slow news day segment of our phone line. Thanks for calling. And we'll look forward to seeing what else happens on the Trumper front.
All right.
Thanks for calling. And the show continues. Now, news from outside the bubble. First of all, about our friends the banks. The vast profits made from drug production and trafficking are overwhelmingly reaped in large, rich, consuming countries, principally across Europe and the U.S., rather than war-torn producing nations such as Colombia and Mexico, according to new research published or reported on in The Guardian. The authors claim that financial regulators in the West are reluctant to go after Western banks in pursuit of the massive amount of drug money being laundered through their systems. The most far-reaching and detailed analysis to date of the drug economy in any country, in this case Colombia, shows 2.6% of the total street value of cocaine produced remains within the country. 97.4% of profits are reaped by criminal syndicates and laundered by banks in first world consuming countries. The story of who makes the money from Colombian cocaine is a metaphor for the disproportionate burden placed in every way in producing nations like Colombia as a result of the prohibition of drugs, says one of the authors of the study, Alejandro Gaviria. Colombian society has suffered almost no economic advantage from the drugs trade, while huge profits are made by criminal distribution networks in consuming countries and recycled by banks which operate with nothing like the restrictions that Colombia's own banking system is subject to, he says. These two economists at the University of the Andes in Bogota is part of an initiative by the Colombian government to overhaul global drug policy and focus on money laundering by the big banks in America and Europe, as well as social prevention of drug taking and consideration of options for the decriminalization of some or all drugs. It wouldn't help stop a drug war in the streets of New Orleans either, would it? And, ladies and gentlemen, also from The Guardian, Amos Giora, knows all about the pitfalls of targeted assassinations, both in terms of legal process and the risk of killing the wrong people or causing civilian casualties. University of Utah law professor spent many years in the Israel Defense Forces, including time as a legal advisor in the Gaza Strip, where such killing strikes are common. He knows what it feels like when people weigh life and death decisions. Giora, no dove on such matters, confessed he's deeply concerned about President Obama's kill list of terrorists and the way they're eliminated by drone missiles. He believes U.S. policy has not tightly defined how people get on the list, leaving it open to legal and moral problems when the order to kill leaves Obama's desk. He's making a decision largely devoid of external review, he told the Observer newspaper, saying the U.S.'s apparent methodology for deciding who is a terrorist is, quote, loosey-goosey. Revelations in the New York Times this week about the kill list show the Obama administration defines a militant as any military-age male in the zone where its drone attacks. Giora sees Obama as the same as George W. Bush, his predecessor, just much more enthusiastic when it comes to waging drone war. If Bush did what Obama has been doing, journalists would have been all over it, he says. Obama has also presided over massive expansion of secret surveillance. You know all that. And the campaign against Mitt Romney's association with Bain Capital was abated, at least for this week, when it became known that one of the major contributors to the Obama reelection campaign is a managing director of Bain. But it all works out. So, next baseball card, Abu Hama in Yemen, huh?
Yes, sir. Kind of on the bubble, kill-wise.
Well, owns a gun. That's not good.
Unless he lives in Texas.
Well, leads a Boy Scout troop. That's not bad.
As long as he's not a priest.
Okay, Mr. Brennan, this is a tough one. To kill or not to kill, that is the question.
Daddy?
Hey.
Malia says you're friends with a vampire.
Hi, honey. Daddy's busy right now.
But Daddy, I haven't seen you at all since I got home from school and
it's a half hour past your bedtime, young lady.
Mr. President, deciding who to kill makes me kind of thirsty. I'll get a refreshment and be right back.
Sorry, Daddy.
No, kitten. I'm the one who's sorry. Too much collateral damage.
What's that?
Well, you know what collateral means.
Sure. That's what you give the bank to guarantee a loan.
Right. Well, some of it's damaged. Now, what's all this about vampires, kitten?
Well, Malia said your friend Mr. Levine is a vampire. Is that true?
Well...
Can I meet him?
Now, hold on a minute there, princess. What is it we do with a series of questions?
Call Mr. J and ask him to draft a press release.
We take them one at a time. Mr. Levine isn't a friend. He's a donor.
But at the dinner the other night, you introduced him as your good friend.
Well, sure, but that's a different language. That's donor speak.
Donor speak?
That's right, princess. Somebody who gives $10,000 is a friend. Somebody who gives $100,000 is a good friend. Somebody who gives $250,000 is a dear friend.
What about somebody who gives $1 million?
That's either a stranger with an agenda or a blood relative. Now, second, nobody ever said Mr. Levine was a vampire.
What, this boy at school, Tupac?
Mm-hmm.
He said there's an ad for you that says Bain Capital is a vampire. And Mr. Levine is... He's
managing director of Bain. That's right, Sugar Plum. But our ad was very careful to say Bain Capital is like a vampire.
You mean it bites girls in the neck and makes us... them live forever? Why would you be advertising that? It sounds kind of cool. except for having to always wear stuff around your neck.
Like a vampire in that it sucks the lifeblood out of the businesses that it buys. It was a metaphor.
It was a simile.
Right.
A business vampire.
That's right, sweetie. In 30 seconds, you don't always have room for all the words. You have to be kind of telegraphic.
You mean Twitter-like?
That's exactly what I mean, Kitten.
So, even if I met Mr. Levine, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have centuries of moonlit love to look forward to.
I'm afraid not, Princess. Maybe if you were lucky, an hour to Starbucks.
But he's like a vampire, right?
Well...
Like drop-dead handsome like a vampire?
More like stay-alive presentable.
So, Daddy...
What, sweetheart?
He gives you money.
In a way, yes.
But he's like a vampire.
In a way, yes.
But not in the heartthrob way.
In a word, no.
So, Daddy...
Mm-hmm. Why does Daddy take his money?
Uh-huh.
Because if I'm nice to him, he might just become a dear friend. Now, Daddy needs to get back to his kill list, Kitten, and a certain princess needs to go to bed.
Okay, but Daddy...
Mm-hmm.
Am I on your kill list?
Oh, sweetheart. Not unless you're a young man of military age in a failed state. You're not one of those, are you? Give me a guess.
Good night, Daddy.
And, ladies and gentlemen, on the subject of hearts and minds, this reported by the Washington Post. In the vast rugged terrain of southern Yemen, an escalating campaign of U.S. drone strikes is stirring increasing sympathy for al-Qaeda-linked militants and driving tribesmen to join a network linked to terrorist plots across the United States. After recent U.S. missile strikes, mainly from drones, the Yemeni government and the United States have reported that the attacks killed only suspected al-Qaeda members, but civilians have also died in the attacks, say tribal leaders. They're making people say, we believe now that al-Qaeda is on the right side, said a businessman, adding that his two brothers were killed in a U.S. airstrike in March. Hearts and minds, babe. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't talk much about personal stuff, but this week my father-in-law passed away. So this show is dedicated to Handel Owen. It was a privilege to know him and to love him.
Oh, my father's voice was a very special thing. And when I went to sleep, I knew I'd wake to hear him sing. And every morning when he warm up, there was hope that it would bring. In the joy on his face when he reached that hallowed place, and I had no choice. I love my father's voice. My father's voice was a very special thing, and in our house of mirrors, there was safety it would bring, and the clouds above my bedroom, they would part and show me spring. And my pride reached its fill, and my sadness lost its will, and I had no choice but to choose my father's voice. still a very special thing. Yet he doesn't seem to understand the pleasure that it brings. Every moment that he sings those Christmas hymns, and I'm proud and I'm pleased that in him must see me. I'm the acorn, he's the oak, heart stronger, heartfelt bloke. Neither one had any choice, so I am my father's
show returns next week at the same time over these same stations. And the program is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the rubber promise and the home of the homeless.